We'll get started. Hello, today is May 21st, 2016. My name is Matthew Peake. I'm the Military Collection Archivist at the State Archives of North Carolina. And we're here at the State Archives building in downtown Raleigh to interview Chris Short, a U.S. Air Force veteran. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
And do we have your permission to do the interview?
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's get started. Where were you born? Where are you from?
Western North Carolina. Spent a lot of time in the state of North Carolina growing up. Asheville, Hendersonville, Charlotte.
Okay.
Mount Airy, Winston-Salem. Most recently, Raleigh, Wake Forest area.
Okay. What did your parents do?
My dad, he was a recruiter for McDivitt & Street, a big construction company. And my mom was a teacher.
Okay. So did you work any construction
in high school? Spent a lot of time like helping dad with like carpentry projects for neighbors and stuff on the weekends and everything. But I didn't actually do any construction. By the time I was of working age, I worked in some warehouses, some textile mills and stuff.
Okay.
Furniture industry.
Yeah. Typical Western North Carolina.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of funny how that worked out. But later in my high school years, I got into IT. It was just happenstance. Oh, you're young, you know how to use computers. We need some help with like this inventory control system that's using barcodes and stuff. And
okay,
I dived into IT at that point.
That was really early.
Yeah, like mid-90s. It was pretty awesome.
So where did you go to high school?
I actually went to three high schools. I went to a high school in Ocala, Florida, for my freshman year, and I came back to North Carolina to Hendersonville High School.
Okay.
And then I finished at Hickory High School.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of moving.
Yeah, it's kind of what I tell my wife is like, by the time I was done with high school, I was done with school.
So you knew you weren't going to go into college.
Yeah, like by the end of my junior year, I just knew like I need to just be for a little bit, right?
And,
wherever that may be, whether it was Hickory or whether it was someplace else, it was fine. I just wanted to do something different with life.
How did you get into military service?
So it was the late 90s, graduated high school in 1999, and I was working for like a small, dial-up internet service provider. So, the whirring, the beeping modem thing, that was me. You were calling, one of my places. And it was based out of Hickory, small company, but the dot-com bubble started. And we slowly started losing more and more customers, and then broadband, like high-speed internet, was coming into the home. So I graduated high school, and I was like, yeah, I can keep doing this job, right? Yeah. They're like, yeah, for minimum wage. And I was like, ooh, that's probably not going to be a good long-term strategy. So at that point, I decided to join the Air Force.
Okay. Where did you go, and when did you sign up?
So I signed up, it was delayed enlistment, so like I did all my stuff in September of 99, but I didn't actually go to basic training until late November.
Okay.
So like the week before Thanksgiving, 1999. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, that was pretty crazy. So like you show up, it's basic training, it's the middle of the night, you get off the airplane, you're in San Antonio, Texas.
Is that where you went for basic? Okay.
Yeah. So all the, Air Force since the beginning of, the Air Force, like all basic training has been in Lackland Air Force Base. So you get off the airplane, you're like, you're just walking down, it's like literally a bunch of kids just walking down the hallway, fresh out of high school. And you turn this corner and there's like 150 kids just sitting there like Indian style on the floor, like real serious looking. You're like, oh, so it begins in the airport. Awesome. So you get there and it's hot, it's muggy, it's San Antonio, Texas, right? Just what you would think.
Yeah.
And then like there was a week of that, and then it was like the coldest San Antonio winter in like history. It was ridiculous.
Picked a great time to
enlist. I mean, it was nuts. We had snow at one point.
Really?
Like, we were outside doing PT in the snow in San Antonio, Texas. It was nuts. I mean, just the experience of basic training, like, I never want to go through it again, but it was really, really enlightening as to what the human body can take.
Yeah. When you, as you said, when you get off the plane, what were you thinking? Like, is it...
You have made a choice, and you're stuck in it now. Here we go. Like, there was no doubt in my mind that, like, if I didn't want to be here, I could leave. But, at that point, you're kind of like, you're burning a bridge.
Yeah.
So you're constantly just like, get me to the next meal. Get me to the next time I can go to sleep.
Yeah.
Like, that becomes your mindset slowly but surely, right? So the idea of, getting up, cleaning up everything, folding everything a certain way, running, eating, learning, running, eating, learning. Like, this perpetual cycle, like, that was okay with me. Getting screamed at and, like, you know, having these, like, weird incidents happen at basic training. Like, our first day there, like, a dude slipped and fell in the shower, like, dislocated his shoulder completely.
Really?
Like, came completely out of socket. Like, picking him up, like, you know, it's just a bunch of wet, naked men picking up, you know, this hurt guy. Carrying him out. It's like, what's going on here?
So, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So how long did your basic last?
It was 6 weeks. I actually ended up staying there a little bit longer because, like, right at the end of 99, there was this weird, like, flu outbreak. And no one could figure out what was going on. Like, we got, like, a series of shots that are like, hopefully this will help, you know. So, like, guys would, like, they'd wake up in the middle of the night, like, night terrors, sweat, cold. And we had no idea what was going on. So, like, we'd throw them in an ambulance, and off they went. And they'd show up, like, a week later. And then eventually it hit me. So, like, I remember waking up in the hospital New Year's Eve, 1999.
You're having a great time with holidays.
Yeah, so I'm in the hospital, and, like, I'm in this room. Like, I remember nothing from, like, I went to bed to, like, it's dark out. So I have no idea what time it was. So when they tell me, you know, like, hey, you basically just lost a day from, like, just delirious high fever stuff. And you're in a wing of the hospital in Lackland Air Force Base that has been cordoned off just for this, like, outbreak or whatever.
Wow.
Weird. They never told, never figured out what it was. But it was, like, the end of my time there. So, like, the day that I got sick, I missed my opportunity to get orders. So I had to stay there another week to go through the cycle of, you know, issuing orders, sending you to places, transportation, that kind of thing. So it was a week of, like, yes, you're done with basic training, but you're still, like, hanging around.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. And then, like, my parents, they were coming down for my graduation, New Year's Eve, 1999, and the Y2K bug was going to hit, and no one knew what was really going to happen.
Everybody thought the computers, but you were going to fail, but you were out.
Right, so, like, I was good, you know?
Even if it had gone down, you would have been out.
Yeah, so, it was funny, because, like, they described it to me as they show up, they're in this, like, visitor center, it's this massive building, you have chairs, everybody, and each, you know, flight of, you know, airmen come in, and they meet their parents, and, like, you know, hey, this is what we did, and da-da-da-da. And, like, eventually, they got to the point where it's like, there's no more new people showing up. Mm-hmm. My parents are kind of looking around, like, what's going on? Because they didn't know who I was with, my basic training instructor, nothing.
And right? The Air Force didn't notify them.
The Air Force, I mean, like, it all happened so quickly. Yeah. They were, like, in the air when I was, like, coming to, basically. So I tried to call them, obviously, but they were gone.
And this was before the time of cell phones.
Before the time of cell phones, like, I had a pager my senior year of high school, you know, like, and that was, like, a big deal for work stuff.
Yeah.
So you couldn't, like, just reach out and email somebody or, you know, send a text message. So, yeah, they show up at my hospital room and they're, like, you know, hairnets, mask, like, goggles on because they didn't know what was going on. I was just like, I have no idea what happened. I don't know what's going on. I don't know, like, when I'll get out of here.
It's an interesting basic training.
Yeah, like, it was really, really weird. But then, like, you spend, like, the next week, like, doing, like, these odd jobs around base, and one of them was helping with the next week's, like, graduation. Like, I was coordinating a flyover, and I was like, wait, I'm brand new to the Air Force, and I'm coordinating, like, with a pilot to fly over the graduation at Lackland Air Force Base. I was like, okay, like, this is how they treat airplanes. You know, anybody can handle this stuff.
Were they just off trying to find a job for to keep you
busy? Yeah, just literally keep me busy for a week, right? Okay. So, not necessarily, like, cleaning up around the squadron or whatever, because, you know, you were given some respect at that point, because, like, you had gone through everything. It sucked that you got this, you know, illness or whatever, and you had to stick around another week. So, yeah, like, the military training instructors that we were with, they were very chill. Like, they did not care what we were doing at all as far as, like, you know, is your stuff cleaned up? Just, you know, just don't get in the way.
Yeah.
Basically. So.
Well, after you got better, since you missed your orders, did you think about how missing those might have affected where you'd be stationed next?
So, I mean, I knew I was going to Keesler Air Force Base for training.
Okay.
It was just which class I would start with.
Okay.
So there's, like, you know, a window of time where you'd just be waiting.
Yeah.
A class would start. So basically what that meant was my window of time, because it was the end of the year and everything, my window of time, instead of waiting for a week at Keesler, I waited for a week at Lackland, which was kind of nice. I mean, you know, because you'd rather be the senior person in a basic training unit and not the brand new person at a military, like, tech school unit where you're, like, you know, people did, like, what they called weeds and seeds, where they're like, you know, weeding, you know, rock beds and stuff and everything. I was like, I never had to do that because I was at Lackland, you know, doing all this silly, you know, busy work kind of thing. So, there was some impact there. Like, I met people that I was going to go to this class with before I got there. So, like, I already had some friends made before I even arrived.
That must have made it a little easier.
It was. And there was actually a buddy of mine, we nicknamed him Peaches because he was from Georgia. And we're still friends to this day.
Wow.
Yeah, and I met him because I was, like, bunking with him, and he and I went to Keesler together.
The random fate of the military.
Right, like, it's totally, like, random that this happened, and yet, you know, he, like, stayed in a room right down the hall from me. It was pretty nuts.
So, you were sent on to your next location. What were you assigned to do?
So, at the time, it was called Communications Computer Systems Controller.
Wow.
Yeah, and they shortened that to just Tech Control. Thankfully.
Early days of computers really on a daily basis being used by the military, so long names.
But, I mean, we're talking like, they had me study like some archaic stuff, like analog stuff that, you know, the FAA hasn't used in decades. So, all the way up to like the most modern digital equipment they have, routers, switches, you know, Cisco gear, that kind of thing.
MS-DOS.
MS-DOS was huge. I exposed a vulnerability in the schoolhouse one day with a Windows program. I forget what it was called. It was like, it's like not Netcast, but it was some program where, like, if you set it up incorrectly,
yeah,
like you could broadcast to every computer on the network. And basically, I was broadcasting messages to every computer in the schoolhouse, like, hey, how's it going? And like, an instructor would be teaching, like, slides on a whiteboard, and all of a sudden, my message would pop up. And it'd just be, like, totally random things. Like, we started pulling quotes down from, like, people's memory and just typing them in and sending them off. That was pretty funny. That's when they realized that, like, yeah, he's going to figure out some stuff one day.
And for those who are listening, there was no such thing as computer or internet security, really, at that time.
Right, yeah, like, Google didn't exist. Like, search engines were, well, I guess Google did exist, but
Dogpile was the big search engine.
Yeah, like AltaVista, like Yahoo was still like a big search giant back then.
So it was easy to do these types of things.
Yeah, the whole networks. I mean, you think about, like, in this building we're in right now, there's probably at least 5 or 6 different, like, networks.
Yeah.
And back in those days, like, one network covered an entire campus. So if you sent a message out to all computers, you literally hit every computer in a building or in an entire section of Keesler Air Force Base. So yeah, it was funny because like they finally like started going door to door figuring out like where was like a few people sitting around a computer. And it was like the youngest instructor finally found out it was me and he figured out how I did it. And I was like, all you have to do is change this. But like you need to do that everywhere.
So did that help you with...
So, like, he really didn't like me. Because it was his job to, like, secure the network.
Oh, okay.
Because at that point, there wasn't, like, a network security person that sat down the hall. It was, you know, somebody's, like, quote, additional duty, end quote. So your job was to, like, maintain, like, patches and software upgrades and help people out, like, oh, yeah, how do I, you know, do this thing in PowerPoint kind of thing. So it was his job to make sure things like that didn't happen. So he was really, really perturbed with me. But whatever, you know, you allowed it to happen.
What was your daily job entailed? What did it entail?
So it was like the coolest thing about Tech Control was that it was never like the same thing every day. I was very fortunate to get sent to Langley Air Force Base. And I was put in a very specialized unit. At the time it was called Reachback. And what we did was, you know, all these like guard units or, you know, small military detachments that are active duty, they would need to get communication services like phone, internet, secure phone, all the other kind of networks that the military operates. They'd have to, quote, reach back someplace in the States. We were one of those stations.
Okay.
And we were very unique in the sense that we used the exact same equipment they used. So we had basically this small warehouse where it was just full of all this like tactical equipment and mobile satellite vans and mobile phone switches and everything. And it was the only place in the Department of Defense that had its own area code. They have the defense switch network, where it's like, you know, a phone system for just the Department of Defense.
Yeah. Relays back and forth.
Right. Like it's, you know, you pick up a phone on an Air Force base, you can like, you know, Europe was this area code. The US was this area code. Asia was this area code, and we had our own area code.
Okay.
because we could hand out all those phone numbers to different units if we needed to.
So if there was a special operation, they tell you what equipment they had, you could get it set up.
Right, like we would try to use exactly what they had at any given moment, right? So we knew if this unit was going out, they would send out a call out to us, and they would say, you know, this is what we're taking with us. And we're like, all right, we can get you up on similar equipment or the exact same equipment. That way we knew if there was any issues, or if they had any issues, we could walk them through it. We were the experts. And if they were out on training missions, it was extremely helpful for them to come back to us. So it was very, very unique. So we got like the new cutting edge stuff along with all the old stuff. So I got to do a lot of different things at my first job. You know, working on phone switches was something that most tech controllers didn't do. Working in satellite vans was something that no tech controller really did unless you were there.
Because earlier in the 70s, 80s, you had to have specialized training to work on satellite vans or mobile communication systems, as they call them.
Right, yeah. I mean, all this stuff was unique and hardened and designed to be dropped in the middle of nowhere, hooked up to a generator, and start working. And when I say hardened, I mean could take a nuclear blast if set up correctly, right? And cryptographic generation devices and all these things. I mean, you had entire walls of some of these small, I mean, they basically like a shed you would buy at Home Depot. Sized thing, and it would just you'd look in it and you'd be like, wow, the entire nation's secrets are on your shoulders because they can all get processed right here if they need to be. It's pretty intense. But then you also had like inside you have like the newest, hottest Cisco router or Cisco switch, and you know, voice over IP was just taking off, and we were one of like the first buildings in the Air Force to like set up our own voice over IP network because, you know, some Cisco guy left some equipment there and was like, yeah, tinker with it, see what you can do.
Which was scary because there was no security to it.
No, there wasn't really, but we were in charge of our own security. Okay. It was interesting how like that logically worked out because at Langley Air Force Base, you had the first fighter wing, which, you know, the first fighter wing is the Air Force's fighter wing. They're going to get, you know, like they got the F-22s first.
Yeah.
They got the F-15s first. They had, you know, hundreds of F-15s, it seemed like. but then you also had Air Combat Control, which is the combatant warfighting command that, you know, sends out the fighters and bombers to war. That was headquarters there as well. So you had a base commander, but then you also had a combatant commander and a four-star general sitting there. And the base commander was, you know, an F-15 pilot or an F-22 pilot. And then you had the 83rd Communications Squadron, which was like Air Combat Command's central communications unit. So like the Network Operations and Security Center for Air Combat Command, which covered the globe, was right across the parking lot from us. So, you know, things like, what was it, the red worm bug or something like that, like those were like huge deals, and we were on like the front lines trying to figure out how do we defend ourselves against this.
Yeah.
And like all these internet viruses that came out in the early 2000s, like every single time the response was, well, just shut everything off and wait till it goes away. It's like, wait a minute, we can't really do that, right? Like we still have to maintain operations. And I brought that up with one of our stand-up meetings. I was like, aren't we like letting, quote, the enemy win if we just close our doors and walk away from the internet?
And also, if you do that, then by the time you turn them back on, they'll be so out of date, they'll be vulnerable.
Potentially, to yeah. Then you're just setting yourself up for the next vulnerability. Right?
And for those again who are listening, who are much younger than us, between 2000 about 2006, there were at least four viruses that come out every year that would wipe out every system. I think I had my laptop hit twice on a network, but there was no idea how to stop them originally.
Right. Like the military, and the one thing that shocked me the most, because I was working at an internet service provider, I used a lot of Windows stuff, but I had also learned Linux while I was there.
Yeah.
And the thing that shocked me the absolute most was that the Department of Defense just bought into Microsoft. And, like, Microsoft at the time, like, had no security. Like, you installed Windows 98, and the next hour and a half to 2 hours was, like, all you did was install patches and turn off stuff.
Yeah.
Because you didn't want this worm. You didn't want this infection. You didn't want this virus to come in and just lay waste to everything you had just done. And, like, that was the modus operandi. It was just as much features open as possible, make it as easy as for people to use, but also made it easy for other people to use.
And Linux was much safer, but it was a little more.
It was much, you know, unknown.
Yeah.
Nobody, you know, the open source software community was being shunned actively by Microsoft, and no one in the Department of Defense had the time to sit down and really read through all the code to figure out, oh yeah, this is really safe and good to use.
I guess too, there was the if it's open source, and there's nobody to be held accountable for it.
That too.
Stuff can be added to it because it's open source, so we can't,
I mean, there is an audit trail, obviously, but you can't really sit there and say, oh, well, you did this, we can sue you for it. Like, the liability of an open source operating system is hard. So, but, you know, I had a lot of experience with it. So one of the things, one of the opportunities I had my first year at Langley was to participate in, it was called the Joint Expeditionary Force Experiment, JFX 2000. And they were doing some really innovative things trying to defeat the Air Force's red teams. And what they would do, you know, each you know, function within the Air Force had, quote, red team. Like, if you were a cop on base, there was a red team that was going to try and penetrate your defenses or sneak on base and surprise you somehow. Same thing with the networks and computers. We had red teams that would go in and try and figure out how to get on your network, how to do something, and then just surprise, you know, now we're going to display this message across every computer on your base somehow or something like that. So our job, you know, I was this low man on the totem pole, but they were like, you know, hey, you can really help us out with some of this stuff because it's all newer and you have some experience with it. Great, but it was all Windows. I was like, you know, the network tools that are available on Windows aren't great for, like, defending against this stuff. Like, they're just not designed for it.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, well, you know, we can, there's Linux. We could always install Linux on a computer randomly somewhere and just see what it can do for us. And I'm like, well, this is the place to do it. Let's go. You know, why not? And all these old crusty, you know, network guys sitting there like, oh, we don't trust this. We don't think it's a good idea. So, like, they isolated me in my own little network. And I said, well, these are the things that I need to connect to just monitor things at the very least. So they gave me that access. And they were doing a really innovative attempt to prevent the red team from, like, hacking in through the internet. So, you know, you have the internet, which is open, public. then you have a secure internet that's supposed to be isolated from the, you know, regular internet, and no one can really get to it unless you have encryption keys and all this other really boring stuff, security clearance and all that stuff. So what they did was, instead of going the traditional route and say, let's send this encrypted thing over the internet, they said, let's put the internet over the encrypted thing being that secure internet pipe. That way you had to be on that secure internet, which was, you know, isolated to buildings and, you know, special cryptographic access was needed, versus, you know, trying to find some way on from the regular internet to get to some resource that could then be taken down to affect all other operations. So, you know, we were doing that, and they were like, okay, they're attacking our regular internet access, and we had set up this Linux server to just monitor network traffic across the board. No Windows system could do that at the time, and this was all free. And it was just mind-blowing to people. They were like, wow, you can actually see that, like, in real time, and it's drawing a graph and everything? And they were just like, oh, this is great. I'm like, yeah, I mean, this is what it's for. It's, you know, it's designed off Unix. Unix is kind of designed off of working with networked resources and computers. Where Windows is designed for working with, like, Office, you know? So it was really kind of an innovative place to be in the early 2000s. Because you had all the old school stuff, you know, with the analog, like, you know, phone switch patch cables that you see, like, in the old World War II movies and videos and stuff. Then you had, like, full-on digital, you know, Cisco networking.
Satellite phones.
Sat phones were, like, huge. I remember this one unit, they got this, it was called an Inmarsat. And basically it's like, it looks like a big dinner plate that you unfold, and now it's this antenna, and you just kind of point it to the you know, right direction, and boom, you get an internet connection. It's like, you know, not fast, but it's internet in the middle of nowhere.
Survivable
communications. Right, like, so you can get data, you can send data, pack it all up, move on to someplace else. It was really awesome. But they took it out of the box, and they're like, we don't know what to do with this. We have no idea. Like, and it, like, the manual literally was like this brochure, like, you know, a folded up piece of 8 by 8.5 by 11 paper. Like, here's a manual, make it work. Okay, awesome. And, like, not only make it work, but get it working on, like, the base's network and make it so where we can just turn it off, you know, save everything, turn it off, and then turn it back on in some foreign country, and it'll work, and we'll be on, you know, Langley's network.
And the speed of communication developments during this time, I mean, by 2007, you got Twitter, and Facebook. So you go, you've been able to send messages over your phone.
Right. Like, I remember...
from nothing.
Yeah. In tech school, I remember getting a prepaid phone, and it was a huge deal to, like, have a cell phone.
Yeah.
In 2000, 2001. Huge deal to have a cell phone. And in tech school, they would do, like, these random inspections on the weekends. And it would just literally be, like, all these phones, like, the old Nokia brick phones just lighting up with their green and black screens. Hey, he's in this room. Hey, he's in this corridor. Hey, he's in this corridor. So you knew to be in your room at the right time. But it was all like, hey, let's pay $15 a month so we can figure out where the instructors are during inspections.
Yeah.
Like, that was the whole purpose, and you had it in your pocket, and it was great. But then you went from that all the way up to, like, you know, here's Facebook, here's MySpace, here's, you know, Google and Google Earth and Google News and Google Maps. All these other things.
And the technical challenges that came along with that
for you guys. Large distributed systems became the norm.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get started. Okay, I had to change the batteries there, so we're back. Okay, so early 2000s, you're in Laneley.
Mm-hmm.
September 11th, 2001. Where were you?
So, let me back it up a week.
Sure.
The week before 9/11, I was still at the Reachback at Langley. We had a series of exercises coming through. We were having all kinds of problems with cryptography and timing and just all these weird issues. And, you know, I was spending several long days at work trying to work through these issues. And you'd work through one, and another one would pop up. And you'd work through another, and another one would pop up. And it was like this never-ending cycle. So I basically worked myself sick, right? Like, all of a sudden, there was one day, my ex-wife... She was also in the military. She was stationed there across base. She calls the office. She's like, hey, are you coming home at your normal time? Are you going to be late again? I was like, you know, I don't know. I don't feel that great. I think I might go to the doc and get checked out. And she's like, oh, okay. And, like, I hang up the phone, and I'm working on something, and my boss comes around, and he's like, hey, you don't look that good. You look kind of pale. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Well, I'll go to the ER real quick. So my ex-wife meets me there. I walk in. I had a fever of, like, 100. You know, low-grade fever, not a big deal. Someone has a heart attack on base. They bring them in. They're like, hey, you know, we're going to take your temperature again because you're still looking pretty bad. Like, it was 103 in, like, a matter of an hour. So they sent me downtown. So I had, like, some flu thing going on. And they're like, okay, here, you know, you need some fluids. We're going to give you an IV. I'll send you on your way. The next day, my phone rings. And this is, like, Thursday before 9/11, I think.
Yeah.
9/11's on a Tuesday. Right,
it was on Tuesday. Yeah, it was on Tuesday. Yeah.
So my phone rings, and, like, I'm sitting in bed. I'm, like, you know, deathly ill. I don't answer it. My ex-wife comes home. She's like, hey, how you feeling? I'm like, I made it on the couch. You know, it's kind of progress at that point. I pick up the phone. It's a voicemail. One of my best friends had died that I went to high school with. Very sad. You know, he died 20 years old. It was really rough. So, all right, fine, get over the sickness. You got to haul butt back to West North Carolina, go to the funeral. My parents were still in Hickory, so he was buried on Sunday. So we stayed, you know, we hung around with the family a little bit on Sunday, came back to my parents' house on Monday, stayed there and said, okay, we'll drive back Tuesday. And, like, the week before I got sick, my grandmother had died, and I was sick, and then my best friend died, and it was just like, whoa, you know, this is like a lot of life right now, you know, for like this 21-year-old guy.
And was this thing tied to your previous illness during basic training?
Nah, I don't think so. I mean, maybe, who knows? Yeah. It's just like, I guess when I get hit with a sickness, I get hit really hard.
Okay.
So, I don't think it was tied together at all in any way, shape, or form. I think it was just, I literally was working myself to death. It was just my body's way of saying, hey, take a break.
Yeah.
So, you know, all this stuff is going on. My boss is like, you know, hey, don't worry about the leave paperwork. Take as much time as you need. Just go. You know, this is back, you know, the early 2000s. This guy was old school, which was awesome. So he was just like, take what you need. Let me know where you are. If you're, you know, not in North Carolina, you know, just let me know.
Yeah.
It's like, cool, fine. And so I'm an early riser, military guy. I get up. Tuesday morning, 9/11, at my parents' house. I was like, go in the other room, watch the news. Ex-wife's asleep, kids asleep. Parents are off at work already. And turn on the news, and it's World Trade Center. Smoke coming out of it. I'm like, this is weird. What's going on here? And, you know, this is like after the coal bombings the previous year, Khobar Towers a few years before that. You know, the first thing that came to my mind is like, well, I know that planes go flying up and down the Hudson all the time, but the World Trade Center is a little bit inland.
Yeah. And it's a little too tall to miss.
Well, yeah, you see it coming, you know, before you see New York. So, yeah, it's like, you know, at the time, all the newscasters were saying, you know, hey, it's, you know, they think a plane lost track. Totally clear day. It's like, how did a plane lose track? Yeah. Like, that was the most suspicious thing ever. It's like crystal blue sky in New York City at the time.
They were trying not to assume too much.
Right, they were really trying not to draw fear into people. And I was just like, oh, this is not good. Like, that's like, you know, 100 stories in the air. There's no fire ladder that's going to ever reach that high. Like, those firemen are going to have to hump it up, you know, hundreds of flights of stairs to get up there to get the fire put out. I'm like, that's going to take a long, long time. And then, boom, second plane hits the towers. I was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
This is coordinated. Like, this is an attack. So I go and, like, I wake up my ex-wife. I'm like, hey, two planes just hit the World Trade Center. If they hit the Pentagon, we're leaving. I'm going to go hop in the shower. So I go get in the shower, and literally 15 minutes later, like, I'm, you know, combing my hair, brushing my teeth. She knocks on my door. She's like, hey, the Pentagon just got hit. It's like, whoa, what the heck? You know, so hop in the car. I call my boss. I'm like, we're on our way back right now. My ex-wife calls her boss. We're on our way back.
And your role, your job is going to be vital.
Right. Like, there's people going out the door right now that are going to need communications, and I'm one of those guys.
Well,
I'm
going
to help them. You know?
You mentioned if the Pentagon, was it really, you realized it could be that?
I knew it was a terrorist attack.
Okay.
The second I saw the second plane enter the frame, I knew it was a terrorist attack. Like, before, like, that brief split second that you saw it before it got hit, because all you saw on TV was just the two towers standing there, and then this small plume of smoke coming out of one side of it. And it was like the opposite side where the plane had hit it. And then you saw the second plane come into frame and just blast the side of the building. You saw it hit one side of the building, and you saw stuff spew out the other side. And like the second I saw the second plane, I was like, this is an attack.
But I'm interested in the fact that you thought of the Pentagon instantly. Was it just because of your training, or what was it that...
Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, he had specifically said, we're targeting American military.
Okay.
Before the coal attack, he said that. Everybody in the military knew that. If you were paying, unless you were asleep at the wheel, you knew that if you were out somewhere, the military was a target. Now, he also had a penchant for the World Trade Center, because of 1996, the World Trade Center bombing there, where he tried to take it down with the, you know, a truck full of explosives, but that didn't work. So I was, you know, the 96 bombings, I was 16 years old. I was, you know, very aware of what was going on then. So when I was like, this is probably bin Laden. Like, you know, everybody was probably like.
So the idea of the Pentagon.
The idea of the Pentagon getting stuck. Hit, it was just like, you know, if they're using planes on a Tuesday morning in the U.S., there's hundreds of thousands of planes taking off and landing all up and down the East and West Coasts. So if they're using planes, the idea to me was they could have 17, 20 of these things.
Yeah.
You know, because all it took was like four guys to take over a plane. You know, you get 100 guys in a room, you could easily have all these flying missiles full of fuel. So, you know, early morning East Coast, I knew like those planes were probably heading towards the West Coast or something. And they were full of fuel based off the impact of the explosion. It was just like, yeah, they're coming for it.
And the Pentagon's in the flight path.
Pentagon is, you know, you got Reagan right there, you got Dulles right around the corner. So, you know, and I'm just like, well, I bet Langley's going nuts right now trying to get aircraft in the air. Because, I mean, it was 2001.
Yeah.
You know, Bush had just came into office. Cold War was over. You know, Iraq, we were doing Operation Northern and Southern Watch, you know, for the UN.
No fly zones.
Yeah, there were no fly zones in northern and southern Iraq. And, like, that was, like, the only big deal going on. You know, you had some small skirmishes here and there kind of thing. But, I mean, Al-Qaeda was it. Like, that was the only target that was on us at the time. So, you know, we were worried about that. You know, the Chinese economy was coming online. We weren't too concerned about a military threat from them. You know, Russia was always a continual, you know.
North Korea is always threatening.
Yeah, I mean, but it wasn't like, you know, hey, there's a hot spot. We're going to go to it, right? Like, 9/11 just completely changed the game. Just in ways that you would never, ever think possible. Like, you know, we didn't have budgets after 9/11. Like, what do you need? Here you go. You know, if you wanted it, you had four of them. It was crazy. It was just nuts. People were just like, just fix it. Whatever you have to do, get it up and running, get it fixed. Let's make sure this never happens again. So, you know, so it's the craziest thing in the world, you know, they have these force protection conditions on military bases, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta.
Yeah.
Alpha being, you know, kind of like normal-ish. Delta being like, holy crap, we just got attacked. And like, we're in like defensive mode. Boom, immediately, the second the Pentagon got hit, everything went Delta. The entire Department of Defense said, we are completely under attack. And here I am in a Toyota RAV4 driving down I-40. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I don't even have leave paperwork put in right now. Like, yeah. I am, like, if they, like...
How are you going to get back on base?
It's like, how am I going to get to work? My uniforms are at home. I am not ready for this at all.
Was your house on base?
No, my house was, it was an apartment in Yorktown.
Okay.
So I was good there. Like, I could get home. So we get into Virginia. We start getting into the Hampton Roads area, and I call my boss. You know, at this point, you know, I mean, it was like a six-hour drive, but we were booking it.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, if a cop stops us, no.
Cops weren't stopping many people that day.
No, not at all. Like, we were hauling it. I mean, we were going up, or going down I-64 into the Hampton area, and it was just, I easily had the speedometer, like, pegged all the way at the beginning.
Yeah,
you know, we were moving. So I get on the phone with my boss, and he was like, hey, I know you want to come in. I know you want to do something, but I can't get anybody in right now. Wow. You have to be on a list. The list has to be approved by the base commander, and it's going to take you an hour to get on base. So hold tight, stay close to your phone so you can answer questions if any come up, and we'll get you in as soon as we can. It's like, okay, cool. So we get home. And we lived on the third floor of an apartment building, and I forget which direction it faced, but from the apartment building, you could see the return flight path into Langley. And we get home, we unpack the car, everything's settled, and I just go out on the balcony, I just sit for a little bit, and the American flag's waving, and I see 16 F-15s just flying overhead, you know, combat loads. They haven't dropped any ordnance, but first time I'd ever seen like an F-15 with combat loads in the States, ever. I mean, I've been to air shows as a kid, never saw anything more than a fuel tank, right? I mean, these guys had
Bombs for sure.
There was full combat load on these F-15s, and there was not just one of them, not two of them, 16 of them, just flying right over, you know, a few thousand feet coming in the land. And, you know, at the time, Langley had a small hangar off to the side of the runway, and it housed a couple F-16s. That was for, like, missile defense. And the idea was that this guy in the F-16 was just sitting there and could be up in the air ready to fight something in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And they had a faster response time for time of war, and they had elevated to that point and deployed it. Like, the second we heard that, like, windows breaking on base because guys getting off the flight deck so fast and hard, like all the, you know, when an F-15 flies over the coast, they are over U.S. soil. They are not pushing the limits of their aircraft. Like, they have to be in certain airspaces for that. And the reason is because complaints for noise, you know, potential damage.
If the plane fails,
If there's any kind of, like, you know, failure in the aircraft, the plane's going to crash in a populated area, not good. So all those restrictions were completely lifted that day. So, like, you would see, like, when I eventually did get back on base, which is kind of an odd story, you would see planes taking off. And, like, just full thrust, like, burning the rubber off the off the runway from the planes that had just landed as these guys were taking off. And it was crazy to see. It's like something, it was like the back of the future car, like, taking off almost. But it was, you know, an F-15, which normally it would just be like, they'd use all, you know, 10,000 feet of the runway. No, these guys were up in the air in like a couple thousand feet flying off. So, yeah, it was very, very, very scary kind of, you know, what happens next kind of time. Because, I mean, it was, you were there. It was chaos. You didn't know from one day to the next what was going on.
And you had entered in peacetime.
Yeah, completely entered. You know, I came in under Clinton.
How long had you initially enlisted for?
So, initially I enlisted for 6 years. And okay. The reasoning was, for my career field, if you committed to 6 years, you got this like nice little signing bonus. I was like, cool, peacetime, 6 years, doing a job that I kind of want to do is going to help me in my IT career long term. It's a good idea, and I get a little extra money in my pocket at the beginning. Perfect.
Yeah.
You know, 19-year-old kid, 6 years is enough.
Yeah.
So yeah, like 2001, I was entering my second year at that point, and at that point, it was like, oh boy, next 4 years is going to be interesting.
So, and before we move on, I'm interested in that. Looking back, do you think you would have signed up for a fewer years if you had known?
No, it would have been the exact same thing. Because yeah. It was all, I mean, it was a financial decision.
Yeah.
It was not like a business decision.
Okay. But anyway, so you're back. How did you end up actually getting back on base?
So, you know, you had to go through this whole approval process and search process and everything. And like, every day I would call. You know, this went on for like a day and a half. And finally, like I called at like 2 p.m. and my boss was like, I was just about to call you. Your name's on the list, go. And like, I remember like showing up and like the guard was like, you know, it's this guy with full battle rattle,
yeah.
M16, M9 strapped to his chest, you know, bulletproof vest, got, you know, a K9 unit right there searching your car, guys with mirrors going all around it. He's like, short. Because everything was sorted. The list was sorted by rank and then by name. So I was an E3. with an S last name. So it was like the last page. He's like, you are literally the lowest ranking person I've seen on this list. It's like, I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah. But quite frankly, you had one of the more important jobs.
I was, you know, I knew I was good at my job. I'm not going to say like I was the best at my job, yeah. But I was very good at what I was doing.
Let's say it this way. Your role was significant for what was needed at that
time. Yeah, I mean, given my rank, you know, people needed experts to solve problems quickly. I'm not going to say I was an expert at the time, but I could solve problems quickly. So